From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Sedge Thompson, and this is Fresh Air. Michael Moore may be the unlikeliest movie maker to come along in quite a while. An unemployed journalist who decided to do a documentary about what happened to his hometown when General Motors closed the local auto plant. That film, Roger and Me, is a surprise hit. On this edition of Fresh Air, we meet Michael Moore. Also today, author Linda P. Brown talks about what happens when adoptive children, years later, meet their natural parents. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz remembers the late mezzo-soprano Jan DeGaetani, and linguist Jeffrey Nunberg has some straight talk about doublespeak. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Frank Stachow. The U.S. Supreme Court today dealt another setback to civil rights advocates. By a 5-4 vote, the court today threw out contempt citations against city councilmen in Yonkers, New York, who had been ordered to pay $500 a day in fines to force compliance with a court-ordered housing desegregation plan. NPR's Nina Totenberg reports.
In 1985, the Reagan administration sued the city of Yonkers for segregating its public housing. The city, after losing in court, agreed to a settlement that was approved by both the judge in charge of the case and the city council. But the city then reneged on the deal, and the judge imposed daily escalating fines against both the city and the individual city councilmen who now were refusing to implement the plan that they had agreed to. The Supreme Court approved the imposition of the fines against the city, letting them remain in place, but the court stayed the imposition of the $500 a day fines against the city councilmen, and today, by a 5-4 vote, the Supreme Court said imposition of those fines had been premature. Writing for the court majority, Chief Justice William Rehnquist said that only if the fines against the city had failed to force compliance, only then should fines against the individual councilman have been considered. In fact, the city, after paying $820,000 in fines, did cave in. I'm Nina Totenberg at the Supreme Court.
The Columbia astronauts put a Navy communications satellite into orbit today and continued to close in on the path of a floating science laboratory they hope to snatch from space. Columbia is in a slightly lower orbit than the satellite, allowing it to circle the globe a little faster and gradually narrow the distance. 3 days of heavy rains and winds have taken their toll on the Pacific Northwest. Michael Marcotte of member station KPLU has this report.
The estimates run as high as 3,000 people evacuated from homes in Washington and Oregon. One of the worst scenes today was in Lewis County in southwest Washington, where a dike broke, flooding the town of Centralia. One man was killed. The water has closed Interstate 5 between Seattle and Portland, shutting down the region's single most important transportation route. Tow truck operators, plumbers, and hardware supply stores reported booming business. The worst of it may be over now. Most rivers will have crested by the end of the day, and floodwaters are receding. However, there are still homes without power, many closed roads, and a wide assortment of flood damages to assess. For National Public Radio, I'm Michael Marcotte in Tacoma, Washington.
Army officials said today that none of the female military police and other women who took part in the Panama invasion is eligible for the standard combat infantryman's badge following such engagements, but the Army said that would also be true of men who served in non-infantry units. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average fell more than 15 points to close at 2750. This is NPR News. After months of quiet Middle East diplomacy, Secretary of State James Baker is beginning to let his frustration show. It may be a tactic, but Baker is telling Arabs and Israelis to hesitate to start peace talks, that they run the risk of losing his help. Barry Schwide has more from the State Department.
It was a veiled warning issued publicly through Margaret Tutwiler, the State Department spokeswoman, and it followed a private expression of impatience by Baker to Norway's foreign minister on Monday. Last month, it looked as if Israel and Egypt would send their foreign ministers to Washington this month for an opening round of talks. But squabbling over a PLO role is still in the way. So Baker had his spokeswoman say there are many areas in the world clamoring for his attention, areas where the circumstances are producing change. And the statement said, if the effort fails, it won't be because Baker didn't try. The statement could be a pressure tactic, or Baker, sensing failure, could be ready to lay the blame at the feet of the parties. For National Public Radio, this is Barry Schwide at the State Department.
A new study of plant fossils adds weight to the theory that the dinosaurs were wiped out after a giant asteroid collided with the Earth. Jack Wolf of the U.S. Geological Survey in Denver said his study of changes in the shape of leaves of fossilized plants around 65 million years ago indicates a steep drop in temperature for 1 to 2 months, followed by a fourfold increase in rainfall and an 18-degree rise in temperature over the next 500,000 to 1 million years. The dramatic climatic changes occurred at precisely the time the dinosaurs disappeared from the face of the Earth. Other evidence suggests an asteroid collided with the Earth at about the same time, sending a huge cloud of dust or water vapor into the air. Initially, the cloud blocked out the sun's rays, but eventually it would have created a greenhouse effect that would have sent global temperatures soaring. I'm Frank Stasio, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Sedge Thompson. In the new film, Roger and Me, an outside visitor tries to encourage the unemployed of Flint, Michigan to cheer up and remember that joblessness is an opportunity. Though the simple advice is clearly ironic in the movie, the filmmaker Michael Moore is in fact a living example of taking this course of action. Out of work as a magazine editor, he decided to make a movie about other out-of-work people in his hometown of Flint, a community nourished for 80 years by General Motors. For the past 20 years, GM has had a hard time persuading Americans to buy their cars and closed many plants in several states, laid off thousands of workers, and opened new factories in Mexico to help maintain their profits. Moore determined that the cause of the layoffs was Roger Smith, the chairman of General Motors, and the Roger in the title of the film. The me of the film, Moore, began a chimerical search to try to find Chairman Smith and invite him to visit the people of Flint. Roger and Me is an unexpected hit. The film, for which Moore raised $260,000, was bought by Warner Brothers for $3 million, a 1,150% return on the original investment. Moore depicts Smith as the arch-capitalist villain in this comedy. But should Roger and Michael ever have the confrontation Moore seeks, Smith might well admire the financial achievement of the filmmaker. Moore once said he hated documentaries, and I wondered why he then decided to make one.
You know, I'm the kind of guy who'd rather go see, you know, Die Hard and RoboCop and Terminator and, you know, Spinal Tap, I guess, you know. And I think, unfortunately, most documentaries that we see on television have this sort of numbing effect. I mean, either they're already telling us something we know or they're telling it to us in a way that doesn't really motivate us to act. You know, sort of Alastair Cook doing as the frozen tundra, you know, became desolate and the wolves crossed into the path, you know. I guess we all grew up with that, and I didn't want to do that kind of documentary. I wanted to make a kind of movie that people would come to see on a Friday night, you know, take a date, buy some goobers, and enjoy the show.
And your movie is very much, it's autobiographical, and it starts out with, home movies of yourself?
Yeah. I mean, I grew up in Flint, Michigan, the hometown of General Motors, and my dad worked there for 33 years, as did all of my family, And so it's sort of a portrait of my hometown and what's happened to it in the 1980s.
I was curious what sort of motivated you to put together this film?
Well, I was unemployed myself. I didn't have a job, and I was bored and depressed and started going to a movie every day. I mean, I go to those, you know, triplexes where I buy one ticket, you know, and skip between the three movies and just to relieve the boredom. And after a while, after seeing so many of these terrible movies, I thought, geez, maybe I should just make one. You know, these aren't very good, and I don't know anything about it, but what the heck, you know? So I called up some people who had made a film that I liked, and I asked them if they would come to Flint with me for a week and teach me what they could about filmmaking, and they did. And then for the next 2.5 years, I went on to make this film.
What was the most astonishing thing that you learned in the course of making a film?
Oh, boy, that's a good question. just how expensive the whole process is. I mean, it's got to be the most expensive art form around. If you want to write a book, I mean, really only need, you could do it with a pen and paper. You know, if you're making a painting, I guess you need a canvas and some paints. But for a movie, for every 10 minutes you want to shoot, you got to shell out $250 just for the film and its developing. So it's unfortunately an art form that's in the hands of those who have money, which is kind of sad, because if you want to express yourself creatively or put forth an idea and you don't happen to be of the moneyed class, you're kind of, it's tough luck. So I had to sell my house, had a couple yard sales, sold all my possessions, started running bingo games, you know, did everything I could to raise the money to make this movie.
And were the bingo games announced as fundraisers for you?
Yeah. Yeah. Oh. Yeah. Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah. So, yeah, every Tuesday night, 200 people in Flint would show up to play bingo for this movie. I'm sure that's how Spielberg got his start. Don't laugh.
I'm not laughing. I mean, I'm just, you know, amused that that you pulled it off.
Yeah. Well, I mean, am too, actually.
I mean, the total film ended up costing, what, $250,000?
Yeah, about $250,000. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then how did you get it into such wide distribution? What was the...
Well, we entered some festivals, and Warner Brothers had representatives at these festivals, and they saw the film, and so they approached us, as did the other studios and independent distributors, and asked us, they wanted to distribute the film. So we started negotiating with all these companies, and Warner Brothers won out.
Your background is as a writer and an editor. You worked, and you started your own paper, became the Michigan Voice.
Right.
Worked for a short while for Mother Jones.
Right.
And now you're in the world of picking up phones and making deals with Hollywood. What kind of adjustments in your mind have you had to make?
I don't know. Not too many. I mean, I still feel like I'm the same guy. I mean, I still own my two pairs of jeans, you know. I mean, don't back up. They're clean. I don't think much has changed. I don't know. I mean, I negotiated this deal. I didn't get an agent. I didn't get a lawyer. You know, I just did it on my own. But, you know, if you've ever bought a used car, it's pretty much the same thing.
Did you feel like you were dealing with the equivalent of a used car salesman?
Well, now did I say that? No, they're very fine people, and they've done a great job, and they're going to get my movie into almost 1,000 theaters across the country. That's an incredible number of theaters.
And what kind of deals, what kind of stipulations did you attach to your distribution?
Well, in the film, there are a number of families who are evicted from their homes. And so one of the conditions was that Warner Brothers had to either purchase homes or pay the rent for these families who have been evicted, which they agreed to do. They had to distribute 20,000 tickets to the unemployed free of charge and a number of other things that I wanted them to do. And they were very good about it. I mean, they've given me whatever I've asked for.
My guest is Michael Moore. His new film, Roger and Me, depicts the closing of the General Motors plant in Moore's hometown of Flint, Michigan. And this film has had an unprecedented distribution deal with Warner Brothers for a documentary. You were born in Flint, Michigan.
Right,
and,
right.
And one of the aspects of the film is you talk about the heroes of Flint, Michigan are those who left. And I wonder why you feel that.
Well, I think you grew up in a factory town. And I think all of our parents wanted this for us, too. They wanted us to have a better life. And so you always think about getting out. And so I talk about the people who made it out of Flint, the woman who married Don Knotts, Casey Kasem, Bob Eubanks, host of the Newlywed Game, who later in the film makes his triumphant return home to do a version of the Newlywed Game with four auto worker couples in Flint. And tells a joke on camera that has, you know, caused a little bit of a controversy with the film.
It was a joke that could be taken as anti-Semitic, homophobic,
anti-women, anti-gay. There's about at least four groups there that get wasted.
I'm curious. Did he know that he was being taped at the
moment?
Oh,
yeah, yeah.
Did he know what the film was about?
Yeah. Oh yeah. We told him.
Uh-huh.
It was 10 in the morning. You know, he was sober. I mean, it's. You know, I don't know. I can't explain it. That was our hometown boy, though.
What I understand, there's been some legal action to try and quash the film because of that segment.
He hasn't filed anything yet. But the lawyers have been calling. They threatened New York Film Festival with an injunction to try and stop the film from being shown. They didn't do that. And now apparently he sent a letter to B'nai B'rith and they had some joint press conference together or whatever, demanding that the scene be removed. And he's apologized to all Jews. Our position is that he has to send a letter to all Jews, not just to B'nai B'rith. So we'll see what comes of that.
Why did you include a scene like that in the movie, which is basically about GM?
Because when we were growing up and we were kids, we never knew about the sit-down strike in Flint, the 1937 sit-down strike that founded the UAW. And these important people who were really heroes were totally forgotten, wasn't taught in school, never mentioned, but we knew who Bob Eubanks was. We knew that Bob Eubanks was from Flint. We knew he was the guy who had made it. And I just thought that there was something very strange and very ironic about that, and very wrong, that we'd know who Bob Eubanks was, but we didn't know who the sit-down strikers were. And so we went to see him. You know, he's the most famous guy from Flint. It's a movie about Flint. We figured, hey, you know, we had no idea what would happen.
But, I mean, why that particular scene? I mean, why would you include that joke that would be offensive to so many people in this film? I mean, well, he didn't live in Flint, and it wasn't part of the...
It was more. It has more to do with this whole thing of the American dream, which is essentially a dream. You know, this sort of, here's who's made it. And then he returns, and has he made it? Is he a hero? Is he somebody to look up to? When you hear him, when you see him behave in this fashion, you know, he comes down off the pedestal pretty fast in about 15 words.
You're in the film a lot as the... I guess the star of the film, the one who has the adventure going in search of Roger Smith. And you got very close to him a number of times, and then at a Christmas party you were actually in a crowd with him. Were you pleased with the encounter? Did it come off the way you'd imagined it had been in your chase for him?
Well, no, because I wanted him to come to Flint. I mean, I'm very pleased with the scene in the movie. I think it's one of the most powerful scenes I've ever seen in any movie. At Christmas, when as he's giving this speech and quoting Dickens, families in Flint are being thrown out of their homes. I watched that scene now, and I wonder sometimes why I didn't lunge at him. You know, it's the amount of restraint that I showed. I really don't understand it. I probably just was so scared at that moment because he had plainclothes security guards grabbing me by both elbows and trying to pull me away. So I thought for sure I was going to jail.
By that point in the making of your film, had you been sort of known? I mean, people had been told to watch out for the
film. Oh, yeah, yeah. They knew who I was by then and what we were up to. Definitely, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Somehow it strikes me that if you tried to approach the president or head of any corporation or the United States, I mean, in that way, anybody would be treated that way, even an employee of a corporation.
Yeah, except I tried phoning, and then I wrote, and I wasn't getting anywhere, so what do you do? I was out to get him to come to Flint.
What would you have shown him?
Well, I would have taken him to all the things you see in the film, families being evicted from their homes, a woman who's selling bunnies as pets or meat, take him to the Amway meeting, you know, drive him around in the van, have this running conversation with him about America in the 1990s, sort of my dinner with Andre on wheels. That's how I envisioned it, you know, this hour and a half dialogue between Roger and me. I thought it would be an interesting movie.
But you've ended up dining alone.
I ended up dining alone, right?
My guest is Michael Moore. His new film is entitled Roger and Meme, and it depicts the closing of the General Motors plant in Moore's hometown of Flint, Michigan, and its effect on the people there. We'll be back after this short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
My guest is Michael Moore, the director of the new film, Roger and Meme. Part of your search for Roger Smith, the head of General Motors, takes you to the Grosse Pointe Yacht Club. And you've heard that he's going to be there for a lunch, and you want to try to beard him in the den there.
Mm-hmm.
And you end up in a conversation with a receptionist. And I wonder if you can describe how you found this and sort of set the scene.
Well, we've been traveling all over looking for him. We went to the Polo Club and the Hunt Club and the Waldorf in New York and everywhere trying to get this interview with him.
Did you have an intelligence staff that would sort of tip you off? Did you
yeah.
have anybody inside GM who'd call you and say, yeah?
Yeah.
So you had your own deep throat.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. We were able to know a lot of times where he was or where he was going to be or, you know, what was what. And so we heard he was going to be at this charity luncheon at the Grosse Pointe Yacht Club. So we decided just to pay him a visit. I think that's pretty much is all you need to know.
I have a television crew down here with Michael Moore. He's supposed to meet Roger Smith at noon. I have no information.
How often does Mr. Smith come here for lunch or dinner?
The last time I saw him here was for Sportsman's Night.
Yeah, what's that?
It's a wild game dinner.
Yeah, you go out and shoot your own animal and...
Pardon me?
You go out and shoot your own, the animals you shoot, you bring here and eat, or...
Well, some of the stuff is donated.
Yeah.
Yeah, the food's like a rattlesnake and, let me think of some real exotic foods. Alligator.
Eat this stuff here?
Roast beef.
Yeah, that sounds better.
I have a question about the receptionist in this scene who was telling you about the meal that the people were eating. Was she aware that she was being filmed at that time?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
She seemed sort of so oblivious to the camera. And,
I know. I noticed a lot of people did. They never look at the camera. It's I don't know why. I think probably because we didn't look very threatening. I mean, we weren't the 60 Minutes crew. We weren't coming in like that. I mean, we were a bunch of people that never operated equipment before, and we were trying to figure out what we were doing.
But you kind of played off of that sort of yokel image, I imagine, too.
Yeah, but I mean, it wasn't something we were creating. It was really the truth.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we didn't know the difference between F-stop and F-troop. I mean, we are people who do not know how to set the timers on our VCRs. You know what I'm saying? They're still flashing 12, right? So... I think it worked in our favor.
She was one woman in the film that you depicted. There was also a former GM worker who'd started an Amway business and was doing people's colors. And the sense that I got in watching these that they were being made fun of in the film. They were sort of being made sort of butts of jokes.
Mm-hmm. I don't think so. That's not the way I saw it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean. I think the film is a comedy, and it's a tragic comedy. It's a black comedy, and there are a lot of things that happen in the film that are very funny. It's what we're looking at a lot of times is the absurdity of some of this, and this isn't one of these David Byrne true stories things where some guy from New York goes down to Texas to laugh at the locals. I mean, we are those people. The Amway woman is a friend of mine, you know. I played her that scene before we even put it in the movie. She thought it was great. All she wanted to know is if she could hand out her Amway cards at the Flint premiere. And in fact, the biggest laugh in the whole movie comes when I get my colors done. I mean, they're you know, they're laughing at me, I think, because I think I look like such a jerk. But I mean, it is a fine line. I understand what you're saying. But I think these are people who are survivors. The Amway woman, the rabbit woman, people who have decided that they're not going to despair.
Well, you seem clearly to have a great deal of respect for people who work and want to work, and that comes across in the film. Yet the security guards and some of the PR people are people who need jobs and who are working too.
Mm-hmm.
And it seemed like you were giving them a bad time for doing what their work was.
But actually, we filmed them doing their job and doing it quite well.
Mm-hmm.
They did their job. They prevented me from seeing Roger Smith. You know, 2 points for them.
Do you see your film as a documentary or as a movie along the line of Spinal Tap?
It's both.
Mm-hmm.
It's a movie. It's a movie. It's a movie that happens to be a documentary. We use real people and real events. Nothing is staged, nothing is acted in this movie.
A number of people, including Pauline Kael and a writer and film comment, have pointed out that actually there are a number of sequences put out of order. For instance, Ronald Reagan shows up at a pizza parlor and is talking with the people of Flint, Michigan. And this event actually took place in 1980, 6 years before the action of the film.
The movie begins in 1979.
I suppose it begins at your birth in...
Yeah, if you want to put it that way, right?
But there's a. I came out of the theater with a very clear sense of a sequence of events. GM closes plant.
Uh-huh.
30,000 people laid off.
Yeah.
In fact, it was 10,000 people, I guess, in Flint, Michigan, and the rest were in
No, 30,000 in Flint throughout the 80s.
Throughout the 80s.
Right.
But the sense of the film was that it was 1986 that this happened.
How did you get that sense? Because 1986 is never mentioned in the movie.
Because it's the demarcation where everything seems to fall apart in Flint, as you've depicted it,
yeah.
seems to take place when Roger Smith makes this announcement that plants are going to be closed.
But he makes a number of announcements in the film. There's a montage at the beginning of the film of five or six plant closings. You see Roger on there about three times making three different announcements. One of them is in 86, but you never see, I mean, 86 is never mentioned. Mm-hmm. There's one in 83 and there's one in 79.
Did you change sequences of events from chronological?
No.
How do you respond to Pauline Kael's criticism in the
author? Well, all she's doing is quoting from film comment.
Harlan Jacobson.
Yeah, and he was wrong. And he's just wrong.
Uh-huh.
I mean, he's just wrong. What can I say? He had his facts wrong.
Are you saying that the words that he quoted of yours in here are not yours?
No, I'm saying that the whole setup in that article, the things he's saying, the number of jobs, his facts are all wrong.
He has you saying, okay, so you can say that the chronology skips around a bit. That's why I don't use dates in the film. I just didn't want to deal with how to compact 8 years into 2.5 years that we were filming. Mm-hmm. So I don't say, well, this opened in 86, but that happened in 87. The point is, at the end of the Carter administration, factories started to close and jobs started to be eliminated. You'd be happy if I said in broadcast voice in 1979, if I had said something like that. And the Harlan Jacobson says, I think you could have established that with an insert or a crawl, that there wasn't a single blow. And you say, as far as I'm concerned, everything that took place in the 80s was a single blow. We're talking about an 80-year history of this company, and during the Reagan years, this was a single blow. If you're using the Gulf of Tonkin metaphor, where he says that you played fast and loose with the truth, then you're really hung up with this. He says, that's what happens when one manipulates sequence, and that's the core credibility of the documentary. And your response, all artless and every piece of journalism manipulates sequence and things. Now, are those your
mm-hmm.
words?
Right, yeah.
All right.
Right.
I felt as a viewer manipulated mm-hmm. after I learned that the sequence of the film that is very clearly structured to make an entertaining movie,
mm-hmm.
and it was powerful, mm-hmm. and I felt very moved mm-hmm. by it. But I also felt extremely misled.
Mm-hmm. Does it matter to you that Reverend Schuller came in response to the Chevy V6 engine plant closing as opposed to the Chevy V8 engine plant closing? I mean, do you really want to know that? I mean, have you been hanging around PBS that long that you really want that sort of linear, real-time chronology?
I want to know when something is being shifted around for dramatic effect.
It's not. Well, it wasn't shifted around.
And
everything happened in the exact order that it happened in response to the plant closings. The layoffs began in 1979. Reagan came in 80. Schuller came in 83. Auto World opened in 84. The Hyatt and Water Street was in 86. And then the Hyatt was put up for sale in 87 after the last batch of plant closings. Water Street was put up for sale in 88, just this last year. You know, you just don't have your... We could get out the Flint phone book right now and call anybody in Flint, and they would tell you this. I wouldn't go by this article that has been factually, you know, proven wrong, even by the staff of Lincoln Center, which puts out the magazine. Call them. They'll tell you.
My guest has been Michael Moore. He's the director of the new documentary, Roger and Me. We did call Richard Jameson, the editor of Film Comment magazine, and he said they do stand behind the information in Harlan Jacobson's article about Michael Moore. I'm Sedge Thompson, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, John Barry, the author of The Ambition and the Power, The Fall of Jim Wright. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Sedge Thompson with Fresh Air. Tens of thousands of women in America have given up their children for adoption, and for years afterwards, wondered whatever became of them. Linda Brown has gathered the stories of mothers who did meet their children again, and she tells their stories in her new book, Birth Bond, Reunions Between Birth Parents and Adoptees, What Happens After. Coming up, we meet Linda Brown. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews the final album from the late mezzo-soprano Jan de Gitani. And linguist Jeffrey Nunberg checks out the new book, Double Speak. That's all coming up here on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. By a vote of 5-4, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled today that a federal court judge went too far by fining four members of Yonkers, New York City Council for not agreeing to change their votes against a minority housing plan. The court said the federal judge who imposed the fine on the councilman had exceeded his authority. Maria Hinojosa reports.
Chief Justice William Rehnquist said U.S. District Judge Leonard Sand acted too hastily in holding the council members in contempt, adding that Judge Sand should have first tried fining the city before the individual council members. At press conferences today, Mayor Hank Spallone and the city councilmen who oppose the low-income housing projects said they felt vindicated by the decision, which they say will add a whole new impetus to their fight against housing. But Michael Sussman of the NAACP in Yonkers says this ruling will not have any impact on previous city council orders to build low-income housing units.
This opinion gives no substantive hope to the city to get out from under its remedial obligations.
In a dissenting opinion, Justice William Brennan said the ruling may intimidate judges and give public officials more reason to defy reasonable court orders. For National Public Radio, I'm Maria Hinojosa in New York.
In Vilnius, the capital of Soviet Lithuania, more than 20,000 demonstrators jammed the squares surrounding the city's main cathedral in a peaceful demonstration to demand independence from the Soviet Union. The demonstrators vowed together again tomorrow after Soviet leader Gorbachev arrives for a three-day visit. Ann Cooper reports.
Gorbachev's trip to this Western Republic is billed by the Kremlin as a fact-finding investigation. The Soviet leader will be joined by a delegation of top Communist Party officials who are to report back to the Kremlin about the growing restlessness among Communist Party members here. Last month, Lithuanian communists voted to divorce themselves from the Kremlin, forming instead a new independent Lithuanian Communist Party. Party members here say the split is essential for their political survival in Lithuania. But the Kremlin leaders in Vilnius this week are clearly fearful that Lithuania's growing defiance could set off a chain reaction in other republics that are now chafing under Moscow's rule. For National Public Radio, I'm Ann Cooper in Vilnius.
The Associated Press is reporting that the price of the Navy's new A-12 attack plane is about $100 million apiece. This information is from congressional documents, which apparently inadvertently contain figures in the top secret planes. A Navy spokesman said the service had no official comment on the information, which was first reported in the Philadelphia Inquirer. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials closed down over 15 points to close at 2,750.64. On volume of 175 million shares, trading was active. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. For over 30 years, mezzo-soprano Jan de Gitani was one of the world's most admired artists. Last September, she died of leukemia at the age of 56. Her final recording, Songs by Berlioz and Mahler, has just been issued by Bridge Records. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz says it's her most moving performance, and he pays tribute to de Gitani in this review.
Among the greatest losses to the musical community in 1989 was mezzo-soprano Jan de Gitani. Her best-known recordings were her two wonderful nonsuch albums of Stephen Foster songs, which engendered a serious re-estimation of this great songwriter. But you also can't help connecting de Gitani with contemporary music. Many composers like Elliot Carter, Pierre Boulez, and John Harbison wrote for her. The piece she was probably most associated with was George Crumb's Ancient Voices of Children. The vocal style of the cycle, Crumb said, ranges from the virtuosic to the intimately lyrical, and in my conception of this work, I very much had in mind Jan de Gaetani's enormous technical and timbral flexibility. The transparency of her rich, focused voice was like a window into every piece she sang. What composer wouldn't cherish her clarity her precision, her sensitivity. But De Gaetani didn't only sing new music and rediscovered Stephen Foster songs. She recorded the classic song repertoire, Schubert, Brahms, and Wolf, Rachmaninoff and Ravel, down to Schoenberg, Ives, and even Cole Porter. Her very last album, just issued by Bridge Records, contains some of her greatest, most poignant singing. There are the six songs of Berlioz's sublime Nuit d'été, songs of erotic joy and longing and loss. Then come selections from Mahler's Knaben Wunderhorn songs, his settings of folk-like poems found in a famous German anthology, Youth's Magic Horn. Among the five De Gaetani chooses are one of Mahler's most haunting songs, Where the Brave Trumpets Sound, and one of his most mocking, An Attack on Music Critics, which De Gaetani delivers with bold comic flair. Her most astonishing singing comes in Mahler's Rückert songs, five songs about love, beauty, art, and death, and the spirit that transcends them all. The last song begins, I have become lost to the world on which I wasted so much time. The song ends, I am dead to the world's clamor, at peace in a quiet realm. I live apart in my own heaven, in my love, in my song. De Gaetani was professor of voice at the Eastman School of Music. All the songs here are played beautifully by the Eastman Chamber Orchestra in eloquent chamber versions arranged for De Gaetani by her husband, Philip West. David Efron is the conductor. The record's producer, David Starobin, wrote this tribute. In the days before her death, Jan and Phil referred to this recording as their little miracle. That the recording took place was, perhaps, a miracle. But, of course, the real miracle has always been Jan. To the end, she sought deeper meaning and solutions, ultimately revealing to us a glimpse of the limitless potential of human endeavor. Let's remember Jan De Gaetani with the first of Mahler's Rückert songs, the one about the linden branch, in which she sings about inhaling the tender fragrance of nature and love and spring. Thank you.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor for the Boston Phoenix. Songs by Berlioz and Mahler is issued on Bridge Records. This is Fresh Air. This is our daughter. A simple statement in the way Linda Brown and her husband introduced Karen to their oldest friends, who had just learned that Brown had a 21-year-old unacknowledged child. Brown is co-author of the book Birth Bond, Reunion Between Birth Parents and Adoptees. I asked Linda Brown what kind of choice it was to give her daughter up.
Back in the 60s, it really, I would say for me personally, and talking with a lot of other birth mothers, it really wasn't a choice. Because abortions were illegal, and because you just didn't come home with one of those kids back then, it really was the only choice. No one ever said to me and to other birth mothers, here's how you can keep your baby. We'll help you, you know. And certainly the families wanted to, you know, get rid of the problem, as it were. So I don't feel it was a choice. I just feel that at that time in this society, if you didn't have a ring on your finger and you got pregnant, you were going to give your baby up for adoption. And it was almost not questioned.
Later on, you married the father and
yes.
formed a family of your own.
Yeah. We had two sons after that.
Was that kind of strange, ending up marrying him?
Yeah, it felt strange off and on over the years. It was nice in many ways and good in many ways, but it was also kind of strange in the sense of the timing that, my God, you know, 3 years earlier, we probably could have gotten married, we could have raised that child. So that was kind of bizarre to now have lost her.
What had not worked out that you had to give the child up for adoption?
Well, the bottom line was that we had dated each other for several years, but that there was a religious difference. And back then, we each came from very sort of strong-willed families, and they were very much against the marriage. And I think neither he nor I was able to, we were economically dependent on our families. We were both in college. We weren't able to fight against that kind of very strong feeling. And in fact, the 3 years later when we did get married, his father still did not come to the wedding and was still against the marriage. So, but I think as we got older, that even that 3 years made a difference in terms of our independence from our families.
Mm-hmm. And how long was it before you were able to reconnect with the daughter that you had given birth to?
When she was 21, she went back to the adoption agency, and then she found that there was a letter there from me just saying that if she ever did come back, we would really like to know her and meet her. So it was 21 years before we saw her again. Actually, I never saw her. So it was 21 years before I first laid eyes on that baby.
So she was taken from you as soon as you gave birth?
Yes. Yeah. And some women, I think, who stayed in the maternity homes back then did see their babies and did hold them and did sort of have a chance to say goodbye to them. But because I stayed with relatives, the obstetrician who I was dealing with basically said, don't see this child, don't think about this child, and then you'll forget it more easily.
Do you think that was the right choice?
No. Now, again, today we know that probably that's one way to ensure that you can't resolve some loss like that by telling people they can't talk about it. It's very hard to grieve for someone when you're not supposed to even be thinking about it. Mm-hmm. So it probably wasn't the best thing.
So how did your daughter get back in touch with you?
Well, she went to the agency and spoke with a social worker, and we got very lucky because the social worker she spoke with said that you know, I had a letter there and asked Karen, our daughter, if she would like to hear the letter, and Karen said yes, and then after hearing about the update on our family, that we'd been married and had other kids, the social worker asked Karen if Karen would like the social worker to call me, and Karen said yes, she would. And the social worker just called me Thursday morning, September 6, 1984, at about 10 o'clock in the morning, and said that Karen had come to the agency.
What had gone on in her adopted family's life that that allowed her to learn this about the agency and to go on? Had she been told that she'd been adopted and at what age and that she could go back to the agency and check?
She had known she was adopted, I think, from the time she was about 3 years old when her mother got pregnant with the family's third child. And at that time, they explained to her that she was adopted. She grew up, I think, with, which I think is true maybe for many adoptees, with sort of different stories at different times in her life. The first story was that, you know, her birth parents were poor and couldn't afford to keep her and raise her, and they wanted her to have a better life, and so they had adopted her away. As she got older, more toward adolescence, the story shifted slightly to that her parents were both college kids who were irresponsible and who had not cared enough about her to keep her. So that I suspect that probably that had to do with how her parents were feeling maybe at the time. So she grew up with a bit of a mixed feelings, I think, about us as birth parents. But she always knew she was adopted. When she was 13, they had to do the family tree assignment, I think, in 7th or 8th grade, and she refused to do it. She refused to sort of take on her adoptive family as her family tree family and asked to go to the agency to get some information about what she called her real family. They, of course, didn't do that back then. So she did have questions, I think, about us over some years off and on.
How did you arrange, then, your first meeting? Where was it, in a home, in a public place?
It was in Atlantic City on the boardwalk, because I had spent the time of being pregnant with Karen down there with relatives, and Karen lived near there and had grown up near there. And so my husband and I arranged to stay in a hotel for a weekend and meet her there, and we spent the whole weekend together and just frantically tried to catch up with her life and what had happened and why we had made such a decision and how we felt about that and about her family life and our family life. And it was sort of a feeling of complete joy and relief, like, oh, this is this baby, this is what she looks like, she's alive, she's looks pretty good, you know, she doesn't look real damaged or anything. That's great, I'm so glad. But also right there next to that was sort of the realization of 21 years of loss, of the loss of all of those years was right there. So it was sort of a mixture of a lot of joy and a lot of sadness too.
How did you recognize one another? Was it did you arrange to meet in a certain location? What was that instant? Was there an instant of recognition, like, yes, this is flesh and blood of ours from both sides?
Actually, there was for me, because the room that my husband and I were staying in looked out over a parking lot of the hotel, and we realized that in the morning as we looked out the window, and we knew she would be coming around 10, I think, between 10 and 11 that morning, and each car that would drive up, we would look and say, is that her? Is that her? Can you see? Can you see? And finally, I heard her laugh. And she has a laugh that's a lot like mine, I think irritating to some people. And I heard her laugh first as she got out of the car. And I said, that's Karen. That's her laugh. And it was. So, and then, of course, when I opened the hotel room door and she got off the elevator, and she looks more like my husband than my two boys do. And she looks as though she could be a twin sister of my oldest son. The resemblance is... It just about blew me away.
I get the sense that what you've described as your post-reunion has been a fairly enriching time for you. Mm-hmm. But I get the sense also that for a lot of adoptees who go back and try to find their real parents, or their, I guess you use the term birth parents, that it's not necessarily all cakes and honey. It doesn't work out sometimes. And I wonder what happens.
Well, it certainly hasn't been all honey with us. I think Karen and I have a very strong commitment to making a relationship work, and not in the sense of forcing ourselves to have a relationship that neither of us wants, but in the sense that I think we both realized that this was going to be hard work. And I think the reason why it has been hard for us, even though it's good, basically, is because of the original situation that adoptees and birth mothers were in. That is, I think it's really hard for an adopted person to deal with the fact that here's a woman who gave them away. And I think it's very hard for a birth mother to look at this child and try to deal with all the guilt and all the pain and all the loss that she's, you know, that she did to herself and in some ways to the child over the years. I think there's just so much loss and so much grief that some people push the person away who reminds them of all of that. To go into a reunion and to try to have a relationship in adoption as adults, both I think the adoptee and the birth parent need to be in some kind of support group for adoptees and birth parents and adoptive parents, and to be ready to deal with a lot of the pain that's going to come up, because it's built on such old pain, these relationships. One of the things we found in Birth Bond is that the majority of the mothers and the sons and daughters, you know, had good relationships, but they were mixed in the sense that there were problems. It's sort of like they were happy in spite of the pain. In a very few cases, the pain was the greater part of the relationship. And in very few, maybe one or two cases, the joy was pretty pure.
Well, I want to thank you very much for coming in and talking with us on Fresh Air today.
Thank you.
Thank you. Linda Brown, author of Birth Bond, Reunions Between Birth Parents and Adoptees. This is Fresh Air. Coming up later is All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Let's go to Washington and hear from co-host Noah Adams. Welcome.
Thank you. On our program tonight, Andrei Codrescu, the writer and poet and All Things Considered commentator, concludes his reporting from Romania after the revolution there with a trip to his hometown of Sibiu in Transylvania in the Carpathian Mountains. There was a lot of fighting in Sibiu, especially around the town square. Codrescu left that town more than 20 years ago to come to America. Left in the same year that Nicolae Ceaușescu came in control of Romania. He also travels a bit farther out into the country to see his great aunt and her husband, his last relatives remaining in the country. Their retirement years have been especially difficult.
That and other stories on All Things Considered later here on National Public Radio. Doublespeak, the art of manipulating language to obscure meaning, is practiced from Madison Avenue to the halls of Congress. Linguist Jeffrey Nunberg has some thoughts on doublespeak and on one man who spent his life eschewing obfuscation.
William Lutz is sort of a Ralph Nader of modern public discourse. He's devoted his life to eradicating the misuse of language in high places. Lutz is the chair of the Committee on Public Doublespeak of the National Council of Teachers of English. For the past 16 years, the committee has presented an annual doublespeak award to the public figure or institution responsible for the most egregious use of public language. For example, in 1987, the award went to NASA and the space shuttle contractors for their explanations of the shuttle explosion, what NASA called the Challenger anomaly. In 1984, the award went to the Department of State for its press releases describing the Grenada invasion, or as they termed it, the pre-dawn vertical insertion. Lutz has file cabinets full of this stuff, and he's emptied them all out in his new book called Doublespeak. It is a catalog of euphemism, gobbledygook, and deceptive mumbo-jumbo pulled from every aspect of modern life. There's the curious dialect of the airlines, in which flights that make several stops are called direct, and where safety instructions advise passengers what to do in the event of non-routine operations. There's the language of modern food technology, which has brought us such innovations as non-dairy creamer, restructured beef, and low-cholesterol cheese alternates. There's the jargon of education, in which a school board can announce a program aimed at maintaining the optimal wellness of the total community. Not surprisingly, the Pentagon takes some star turns here. A cruise missile doesn't crash, it impacts with the ground prematurely. A machine breaks down because a hexaform rotatable surface compression unit underwent catastrophic stress-related shaft detachment, or in other words, a nut broke. And Lutz includes a number of classic examples of political doublespeak, such as former White House spokesperson Larry Speke's description of the removal of the Marines from Beirut to offshore ships. The Marines are being deployed 2 or 3 miles to the west. Taken in moderation, the book yields an almost prurient pleasure. Lutz chronicles the linguistic peccadilloes of the powerful and the famous in just the way that periodicals like the National Enquirer report their carnal lapses. And in either case, you find yourself experiencing a highly enjoyable sense of indignation. Maybe that's why political doublespeak has been the most reliable staple of language critics since George Orwell. I won't deny this can be a lot of fun, but there are a couple of things worth bearing in mind. In the first place, is doublespeak really such a bad thing? Maybe there is more humbug around than there used to be. But what this shows is mostly that our high officials have to pay more heed to public opinion than in older days and have to cover their tracks accordingly. I'm sure that Genghis Khan was a plain-spoken fellow. You'd never catch him referring to a spear as a manually launched longitudinal projectile. He called a blade a blade. But it would be a mistake to think of this as refreshing candor. If somebody's trying to run me through, I'd assume they'd be worried about how they're going to explain it to the press afterwards. The triumph of hypocrisy is the greatest achievement of civilization. And in fact, the people we want to watch out for aren't necessarily the ones who drape their thoughts in obscurity and euphemism. That game is fairly easy to see through, which is why General Haig was such an easy target in the last presidential campaign. But recent history should teach us that it's just as easy to cloud the truth in plain language as in any other, and a lot harder to get caught out in it. Shakespeare made the point nicely in King Lear when he had Cornwall say, "These kind of knaves I know, which in this plainness harbor more craft and more corrupter ends than 20 silly ducking observants that stretch their duties nicely."
Jeffrey Nunberg is a linguist associated with the Institute for Research on Learning in Palo Alto, California. Amy Sallet and Phyllis Myers produce the interview segments on Fresh Air, with research assistance from Sue Spolin and Rich Banowitz. I'm Sedge Thompson, sitting in for Terry Gross, who's on vacation.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the power in the House, the rise and fall of former House Speaker Jim Wright, John Berry's new book, The Ambition and the Power, takes an insider's view at Wright, who spent a couple of years with him, and the Congress. Also, police artist Douglas Hinkle tells us how he gets people to remember whodunit. That and more next time on Fresh Air.